on a Friday. You're with us for Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story for the summer concert season.
The Grateful Dead played at Alpine Valley Music Theater 20 times in the 1980s. Fans trucked to the southeastern Wisconsin venue from all over the country. Producer Steve Gotcher attended most of those shows. On the day that turned out to be their last concert at Alpine, in July of 89, he decided to record the sounds of the scene in the parking lot. Here's what he found.
When I was 25, I became a Deadhead, a fan of the Grateful Dead. Up until then, I couldn't understand what all the fuss was about. So my friend Kevin suggested that I come along with him to a show at Alpine Valley near Milwaukee. He claimed that once I saw a concert, I would understand. And he was right. So from July 1981 to July 1989, I made my way to that hillside for 19 concerts. In the early 80s, most of the people who showed up had a ticket, with a few looking for a miracle. What started out as a loopy, easygoing crowd who followed the band over the summer swelled over the years into a much larger bunch who just came to party.
What?
You know
how to make burgers? You know how to make little balls and pound them.
It was the scene in the parking lot before and after the show that I found the most intriguing. So I decided to try and capture the setting on tape, wandering around the dusty parking area with my portable cassette recorder.
Morning.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay, how you doing?
All right.
What you doing?
Making a tape for a public radio documentary.
Oh, really?
On the scene.
Huh. Hi, Ed.
The Deadheads started filling up the parking lot early, grilling, drinking beer, playing hacky sack, and throwing the frisbee around. They were smoking, making deals, and listening to cassette tapes of past Dead shows. Sounds, smells, and colors swirled in a collage that overwhelmed the senses and appealed to my young hippie sensibilities. Camping wasn't allowed in the parking area, but you wouldn't have known it with hundreds of tents dotting the horizon as far as the eye could see. I found a few parking attendants, so I asked them what they thought.
We parked about 20,000 just on Sunday. That's before the concert even starts. So that gives you an estimate. It's more than 20,000.
Yeah.
And those are 3 days. And the people that come in the first day are usually pretty good. They don't bother you, and they pretty much do what you tell them to, yeah, for the most part.
It's not their fault they're not that bright.
Yeah. A little slow.
It's kind of.
But if you give them specific directions, they're okay.
Yeah.
People tried to sell everything from watermelon slices, beer, Gatorade, cigarettes, tie-dye t-shirts, stickers, flowers, and some other things not found in stores.
50 cents a slice.
50 cents a slice. Watermelon.
Give me a quarter. I gotta make a ticket, man.
Some hippies in an old school bus with a makeshift kitchen served questionable falafel to hungry partiers. The smell of Middle Eastern spices mingled with sweat, patchouli, marijuana, and the surrounding pine woods. It was like a psychedelic tailgate party. Finally, the time came for the main event, and the tranquil vibe spilled onto the hill, flowing to the stage. The band kicked off with Hell in a Bucket, and then wove their way through Althea, Deal, Terrapin Station, and Morning Dew. Eventually, the Grateful Dead scene became too much to manage and brought the annual gathering to an end. But for a decade, Deadheads came from all over the country to camp in the woods and experience the band's vision of love, sharing, and peaceful coexistence. And we got to hear them play songs fit for a hippie utopia on a hillside near the rolling farm fields of southeastern Wisconsin.
Steve Gotcher is a producer and technical director at Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And Wisconsin Life is part of our weekly edition of Wisconsin Weekend here on The Morning Show. And now we turn to the U.S. Supreme Court and a ruling on partisan gerrymandering. In a 5-4 decision yesterday, the court ruled that partisan gerrymandering fell beyond the reach of the federal courts. Democratic Governor Tony Evers called the ruling devastating for democracy, while Republican lawmakers, they hailed the decision as affirmation of election maps they drew after the 2010 census. Democrats and Republicans have been fighting in court for years over the maps, and now their legal battles could be over. Do you agree with the Supreme Court's decision yesterday? Are you concerned, upset? Have you been affected by partisan gerrymandering in past elections? Has it changed your view of democracy? Join in at 800-642-1234. Jolly Emery is department chair and associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. Jolly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So what exactly does this new ruling mean for Wisconsin's legal battles over partisan gerrymandering?
Sure. So last year, the Supreme Court looked at a case coming from the state of Wisconsin. And in that instance, it was also partisan gerrymandering. But the case was sent back to Wisconsin because the parties didn't have what's called standing. That is that they weren't personally injured. And so they weren't affected by the way the district lines have been drawn.
And this is Gill versus Whitford we're talking
yes,
about.
Okay. Yes, yes, it is. And that was a 9-0 ruling. All the justices agreed that the parties haven't demonstrated standing, and that's a requirement in order to get a legal remedy. Now, the court has said, the majority have said, we are not going to address partisan gerrymandering. And so this is what they call a political question. And political questions are best addressed by elected bodies or legislatures. And that this is outside of the reach, as you said, of federal courts. So with respect to Wisconsin and its claim, it's going to have a lot of problems. The Democrats in Wisconsin are going to have a lot of problems trying to get the court to look at partisan gerrymandering in this state.
So does that mean the lawsuits, they all have to go away? Could any continue?
So there's a little bit of language in the majority decision that was written by Justice Roberts that basically says if you can demonstrate that, in layman's terms, this is so egregious that you have this equal protection violation, then, you know, perhaps we can address it. But there's really very little room left by majority to make these claims. The biggest issue, I think, for Roberts in this case, writing for the majority, is that there's nothing in the Constitution that requires that you have what's called proportional representation. And so how can you make an argument or how can the court somehow require states to create what's fairness and how you define fairness when it comes to parties being able to have representation in their state legislatures or in Congress?
We're discussing yesterday's long-awaited ruling on partisan gerrymandering by the U.S. Supreme Court. Jolly Emery is our guide. She's an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. What questions or comments do you have about the U.S. Supreme Court decision? Join in at 800-642-1234. Jolly, how long have Democrats and Republicans in Wisconsin been fighting over the maps drawn by Republicans? Where does this history go?
Okay, so with respect to the current maps, the map was drawn after 2010, so 2011. And so it's, you know, it's been around almost 10 years now. And obviously, Wisconsin isn't the only state that is concerned about partisan gerrymandering. We have so many different challenges that are being brought up through the courts. But again, getting these challenges addressed based on partisan gerrymandering is going to be very difficult because of yesterday's ruling.
So did the court draw on past rulings to explain its position? What type of explanation do we have?
Yeah, so the court did draw on past rulings. The court has said before that it doesn't want to address partisan gerrymandering. And with respect to the legal reasoning here, as I said before, what Roberts is really relying on, the majority really relying on, is that you don't have any constitutional protection when it comes to parties and the distribution of parties and the distribution of districts within a state or with respect to proportional representation in Congress. So that for them is the sticking issue, this whole idea of partisanship.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and districts lines are drawn by legislatures. And so historically, this is, you know, how the process is done. And obviously, if one party is in power, that party is going to want to draw legislative districts, whether it's for the state legislature or for Congress, to benefit its party. Its party's goals are to get people elected to office. And so it's, you know, telling, and it's not uncommon that the court took two cases this time, one coming from the state of North Carolina, where you have Democrats that are concerned about how Republicans redraw in congressional districts, and then you have Maryland, where Republicans are concerned about how a Democratic congressional district was redrawn there. So it just, I think, illustrates very clearly that who's in control in a state legislature matters, which party's in control matters, and they're going to draw those lines to benefit themselves. But the court says, you know, we can't come up with a rule with respect to fairness. We can't come up with some sort of equation that says this equals fairness when it comes to parties and getting people elected to office.
Jolly, this was a really close ruling. What did the liberal justices who opposed it say about their positions?
Sure. So Justice Kagan, in her dissent, she was pretty pointed, and she said this is the most important right you have in a democracy, the right to vote, and that with respect to the way that some of these district lines are being drawn, it is a debasement of people's right to vote. And that language comes from the first case that the court took looking at and decided that you could bring political questions on reapportionment to federal courts. That's Baker v. Carr in 1962, where they talked about how it was debasement when you draw these district lines or don't redraw these district lines and people, their right to vote is basically diluted. But she's trying to make this argument here, and she's just very concerned, as are the other liberal justices.
And we have to pause right there with Jolly Emery, a political scientist at UW-Whitewater. How do you think lawmakers should respond to the Supreme Court's ruling on partisan gerrymandering? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the High Court ruling that federal courts can't strike down partisan gerrymandering. The decision effectively ends a Wisconsin case that challenged election maps drawn by Republicans in 2011. Sachin Chetta directs the Fair Elections Project, which helped organize Wisconsin's lawsuit, and he says voters want to see changes to how maps are drawn.
And so we're going to keep using the legislative and political processes to change how districts are drawn, so we can have fair elections again in Wisconsin and across the country.
What questions do you have about the Supreme Court ruling? Join in 800-642-1234. UW-Whitewater political scientist Jolly Emery stays with us. She's our guide. Let's go to the phones now with Mike joining us from Madison. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. So I think that this is proof beyond a reasonable doubt that they, the government, are corrupt and no longer care about we, the people, when they, the government, choose to side with corrupt politicians over the freedoms of Americans, especially in relating to voting, something that we are currently fighting with other countries around the world to get them to allow free elections. And we won't even allow free elections in our own country. I think this is horrible, especially with Independence Day only a few days away, when we celebrate we the people standing up against they, a corrupt government. Something needed to be done about this now. We can no longer trust our federal judiciary.
Mike, thanks for the call. Jolly Emery, do you find that this is an impact on democracy? What does it say here?
Sure. So what Mike has had to say just reminds me a lot of what Justice Kagan had to say in her dissent, because Justice Kagan said, you know, the people empower the government. And so if you say that there is no way for people to bring this issue to the federal courts for any kind of remedy, then what you're doing is, you know, basically stripping the people of their opportunity to get some sort of solution. Because there's no incentive on the part of a legislature to create some commission if they are able to draw those district lines to benefit themselves. Why would you do that?
Let's take another call. Let's go to Sean joining us from Burlington now. Hi, Sean.
Hi. Our votes don't matter. You got people who win an election in 2010 and then they get to rule for 10 years. And now the Supreme Court, with the political hacks that are on the Supreme Court come in and say that our Constitution doesn't guarantee us a right to a representative democracy. It's absurd. I have no faith in the Supreme Court, in our supposed representatives, or the fact that we even have what's called a republic anymore. It's just absurd. I don't know what to think anymore, and I will not be celebrating on July 4th this year. I just don't have anything to celebrate anymore.
Okay, Sean, and I want to go to this email as well from Bill from Green Lake, who asked that question. Why does the Constitution require a census if not to ensure proportional representation? Jolly?
So the census is with regard to count, right? And the census has to do with representation in the House, and so the House of Representatives. And so it's about redistributing those seats if you have significant population change. But that's a fair question. I think one of the things to think about, if you kind of step back even further, right? Again, going back to these consolidated cases, both parties engage in this kind of behavior when they can. So both parties, major parties, I should say, want to make sure that they can, as much as possible, guarantee outcomes for people in their party. And that makes sense. There's an incentive to do that. I think, on the other hand, you know, what we kind of forget about is we focus on the major parties, and we don't even think how this affects minor parties, right? There's just no way for minor parties or third parties to have an opportunity to win under this system. But, you know, these are all important questions, for sure.
So does the Supreme Court's ruling mean then Wisconsin's current election maps will be used in the 2020 elections, next year's elections?
Oh, yeah, sure.
So,
and then there'll be another census, and then there'll be another opportunity to look at the districts and, you know, reapportion.
So Wisconsin's election maps will be redrawn after the 2020 census. Is there a chance that yesterday's ruling could be good for Democrats? Could they take control of the state legislature next year, perhaps, and then draw their own maps to their own advantage?
Yeah, so that's... Yes. So that is a possibility, right? I don't know how likely that is. Again, part of the problem has to do with the way the districts are drawn, that you create these safe seats, so to speak, for Republicans. And that's a concern on the part of Democrats in the state of Wisconsin in certain districts. But, you know, I think what the majority were getting at in their ruling is that your right to vote is protected, but you don't have a right to an outcome. And yeah, fair enough, except that if you can never get the outcome you want, how is your right protected? And that's kind of what the dissenters are arguing.
So does the ruling open any doors to other forms of gerrymandering, like involving the racial or gender demographics of voters?
So racial gerrymandering has already been something that the Supreme Court has addressed. There had been attempts, particularly during the 80s, to create what are called majority-minority districts so that you would be able to get minority candidates elected more easily. And so the district lines were redrawn in a way that you had, you know, a majority of minorities within those districts. But the Supreme Court has looked at those and said that those are an equal protection violation because they're drawn based upon race. And that's clearly a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. So one of the things that the court will look at still with regard to reapportionment is how the lines are drawn. If you have really funky looking district lines that are obviously trying to benefit either someone by race or gender or by even in instances party, and they're just really strange looking lines, district lines, then you can bring a challenge. If you have in a case where you have malapportionment, that is where one district is drawn in such a way that there are, you know, lots and lots of people, like in an urban area, and then another district is drawn in a way where you have a much smaller population, then you have, you know, problems with regard to representation. And so those challenges are brought, and those are the first types of challenges that were brought to the court with regard to malapportionment.
Let's fit in one more call here. Jimmy in Valley Junction. Hi, Jimmy.
Morning. Yeah, I would just point out that I'm sure if the Democrats had were in power totally, they might have done the same thing. Look at the situation in Maryland, which I understand was probably gerrymandered versus Wisconsin by the Democrats. So when the Democratic Party gets back in power, they need to remember this and enact legislation or a constitutional amendment to change the way it's done to some kind of a nonpartisan commission or something that's fair that they think, instead of turning around and doing the same thing the Republicans did after 2010. I'll take my comments off the air.
Jimmy, thanks. And Jolly, is there any momentum on that toward a nonpartisan commission or anything like that in other states and in Wisconsin?
I don't know. I would assume that there's probably something along those lines, but I can't tell you.
Has there been any momentum, though, in Congress or in Wisconsin's legislature to take action on partisan gerrymandering? Is this something the legislature even has an appetite to take up?
I'm sure that there are some legislators, particularly Democrats, who would like to take this up. But it's, again, you know, based upon the composition of the legislature, it's something that's going to be very hard to get passed. And then I think Democrats are also aware that if you pass this, then you're not going to have that same opportunity once you hold the majority.
Really quick here, touch on another Supreme Court ruling yesterday. The court rejected President Trump's argument for including a citizenship question in next year's census. What could that ruling mean for future elections in Wisconsin?
In terms of a census question? That's a good question. I don't know exactly how to answer that, except that one of the concerns with respect to that citizenship question was that it can affect federal dollars. It can also affect, the redrawing of district lines, too, because if you have people who are afraid to answer that question and you have inaccurate counts, and this was one of the arguments with respect to the question, if the counts are inaccurate, then some states can be hurt because you're not really measuring their population correctly. And when it comes to redrawing those district lines for the House of Representatives, then those folks could lose out because, you know, it's set at 435. The other issue is with respect to federal funding. So if there's an undercount because people don't want to be identified as non-citizens, then states can lose money.
Yeah, impact states. Yeah. Jolly, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
Jolly Emery is an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.